Hey, welcome to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative professionals and entrepreneurs looking to grow by learning new things, getting inspired, and breaking down the barriers that prevent them from doing the work they were born to do. I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to episode 139, Interview with Nathan Mielke. Nathan is a cinematographer with a passion for visual storytelling. In 2013, he shot his first feature, a low-budget horror slasher film, Made Me Do It, and most recently graduated from the American Film Institute with an MFA in cinematography. In this episode of Getting Work to Work, we talk about how he prepares for a scene, what he learned shooting his first feature, how music informs his work, and the movies that changed his life. Show notes and links for this episode can be found at gwtw.co/139. Getting Work to Work is brought to you by Chris Martin Studios, a media production company telling stories with heart, edge, and fearlessness through video, podcasts, and design for those who dare to build a better world. Keep in touch with Chris Martin Studios by signing up for the Curiosity Lab, my weekly email newsletter at gwtw.co/139. By doing so, you'll receive inspiration on Mondays and Fridays with ways to increase your creativity, curiosity, and wonder. All right, you ready for this interview with Nathan? Cue the transitional music.
My name is Nathan Mielke, and I'm a cinematographer, and I work in the film and TV industry, trying to be a cinematographer and get into that field, but have been doing this for a long time since, I mean, you could say since middle school, but that's debatable.
Well, we'll touch on that in a little bit, but definitely not debatable. But for the listeners who may not know, what is a cinematographer?
So a cinematographer, in terms of, I would say, the narrative world, not documentary, is kind of the chief over the camera and lighting crew logistically. And they work alongside the director to develop what most people will call a look for a film or TV show or whatnot. But I prefer to call it like visual language of a said story. But there's a lot more in depth beyond that that we can dive into. I would say that's kind of like layman terms of what a cinematographer does.
Well, I like how you describe too visual language, because when you connect that to camera and lighting, it really encompasses many different crafts in a sense.
Yeah, it's a fun job because it encompasses so much. And what I love about it is there's both a heavy artistic side and there's also a both technical side, which I will say, like, the technical side, I was not good at whatsoever for a long time, but I've been kind of coming into the last few years. And what's exciting about that is the more you can learn about the technical side, the more it informs how you can achieve your artistic vision or your, or what you want to create.
If you could just give a glimpse into some of the technical things that, you had to learn and bump against, because, you know, sometimes we think, oh, well, I'm just going to, you know, put a really fast lens in on my camera and I won't have a problem with lighting, or, you know, I'll just wing it, you know? So, like, what are some of the technical things you actually think about?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is getting to know what camera you're using or what film stock you're using. I think that's where I had to grow the most. And now learning that and knowing that makes me way more comfortable doing what I do, in a sense of, I know what this camera can achieve. I know how much I can underexpose. I know how much I can overexpose. I know exactly where I want to put certain things in the frame to convey this or that about the character or the story. And I'm confident in knowing technically where I need to be and not, I thought I could see this, but I can't anymore. It looked fine on the monitor on set, but now that we're like color grading this thing, I can't see it anymore. What's up with that?
So would you say that what the technical kind of allows you to do is to produce an image that's going to be consistent when you go from set to editing?
Yeah, I think it's just coming to learn what tools I'm comfortable trusting. A lot of cinematographers have different ways of how they want to expose the image. Some use light meters, as I do. Others use waveform monitors, and some people just use monitors. And so it's coming to like learn how to use those tools and how you can trust them to where you know that maybe something doesn't look exactly right here, but you know it'll turn up down the pipeline. And then just testing cameras to actually see what they can actually do and not always trusting what the manufacturer has to say.
Well, it's funny because in today's world, it can be really easy to just buy a really expensive camera. I won't name drop any brands or anything, but there's a at least in this area of the country, there's some very popular brands that people like to buy. They go shoot some test footage of nature and pretty people, and then they say they're a digital cinematographer. You know, how do you approach cinematography as a craft beyond just knowing one camera and maybe one or two light setups?
Well, I've been like, first of all, real fortunate in just my life in general of I've never really been in a place where I've had to be that person that has to go out and buy a camera, except for like getting started first. So obviously my parents bought me this little mini DV camera in middle school that I got started on. But beyond that, I've always been surrounded by people like you, Chris, who have let me use their camera. And so I haven't had to go out and make that purchase.
I am thinking about vans and, you know, putting a camera in the middle of the road when the van is passing over the camera. But, you know, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah. No. It's all about risk taking.
That's right.
When the camera owner is not around.
That's absolutely right.
I think what was the benefit to that is I then got to experiment with a lot of different types of cameras. And obviously growing up, I've come along in the age of like how technology has progressed. So as I get older, the technology is getting better and better and more accessible. So like in college, in undergrad, it was like the DVX camera was still real popular with the HVX coming out. Now doing like HD mini DV or with the P2 cards. And then, you know, shortly after was the Red Revolution and then Alexa. But I think beyond, it's so easy to get caught up in, oh, let's shoot on this camera or on these lenses. I think cinematography is so much more than that and so much more than what you said of getting an expensive camera and making things look pretty.
Yeah.
I don't think cinematography is making things look pretty.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier too that it's a visual language. And so when you're working on a set, how do you communicate a visual language verbally?
Ooh, that is the that is the key. I mean that's what's so fun and difficult about filmmaking is the communication part, right? Communicating what you want to do in words. How do I say in words what I want to do visually? And so for me, I mean, it usually happens in the prep with the director of either looking at movies, looking at photography, and kind of examining different aspects of how things are shot, how we can shoot things. And depending on the director, it can get super technical of like, well, let's do this and we can achieve it this way. Or it can be pretty just creative speak. And then it's up to me to figure out what we need to achieve that. I don't know. There's just so many tools at your access to tell a story. And just like, do we move the camera? Do we not move the camera? If we do move the camera, how is that movement? Is it very precise, calculated movement? Or is it unpredictable movement? And then you have composition. How do we want to compose these characters? Do we want to do clean singles? Do we want to do dirties? How does that convey relationships? How does it convey how this character is feeling? You can do that with the depth of field you choose to use, like what stop you shoot on the lens. Like, how do I want this world to feel with how much is out of focus or how much is in? So there's so many of those types of things that I bring into the conversation with a director of how can we use these to tell our story? How can we use these things to make the audience see the world, how this character sees the world, or make the audience feel how we want them to feel, whether that's with the character or against the character. And those conversations happen a lot prior to being on set. Hmm. Usually on set, there's not much time to really have those conversations because you're just worried about making your day.
You're describing a very heavy communicative process before you even get on set. Is there anything that you are doing on set that's improvised, or is it really calculated and planned every step of the way?
It really depends on the project and honestly the director, but this is like one area that I feel like I have significantly grown in. Is before I felt like I had to plan everything out, especially with my lighting, because I just wasn't as confident in my lighting. So I was like, well, I need to know what the blocking is so I know where I can put my lights. But that's just really not how it works most of the time. Yeah. You know, you'll get on set and you do a blocking rehearsal, and then, you know, the actors, for good reasons, will want to do things differently than what you and the director talked about. And then that changes a whole plan I had. I can't remember the exact quote, but Roger Deakins said it really well, as he does with most things. A good prep is, and I'm totally butchering what he said, so it's not an exact quote. A good prep is to where it gets you prepared to what you know you need to do, but puts you in a position to where then you can be flexible. And that's where I've really tried to grow, is get to a place where this is what we want to achieve, and this is how we can shoot this scene. Like, we shot Liz the scene, these are the shots we have. But you know what? When we step on set and we watch that blocking rehearsal, I'm going to look for new things. I'm going to see like what the actors bring, or maybe there's something about this location that I didn't see before in the scout, or there's like things that do pop up on set that's like, oh, you know what? It'll convey things a lot better if we put the camera over here versus where we thought we were going to put it. Or, you know, we don't need as many shots. We've told the story of this scene in these two shots. Yeah. We don't need the three other ones. I'd say most of it happens in the prep, depending upon the project. But then it's those like little things. And I think that's something that you have to be very aware of, because it's easy to go through your day on set and not see those things and just stick to your plan. And then sometimes you walk away from a project being like, ah, you know what? The camera just wasn't in the right place for that scene. Or, you know what? The lighting, yeah, it's technically in the right spot, but it's not for this scene.
So that just describes a process that, even though, you know, you have all of these insanely talented professionals working on a film, there's still so much to learn after every scene, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And even so, after every project, it's like I go through a whole debrief of the fun, conflicted, really proud of stuff and really disappointed about in yourself about stuff. But another thing, too, that happens on set is also, it's not just my conversations with the director or the production designer, but it's also with the gaffer, who's the head of the lighting department, and the key grip, who's the head of the grip department. It's conversations with them. It's conversations with the camera operator, if I have one. It's conversations with the first assistant cameraman. And they're always bringing things to me as well of, well, what if we do this? Or what if we do this? Like, we go in with a plan, but they're also have that awareness. And I think that's what's so much fun about filmmaking, is when you have that collaboration and you have that relationship with your keys to bring in their perspective and their opinion of what they think is best.
That's cool. In 2013, you shot your first feature, Made Me Do It. Even though you had made, I would say, hundreds of short films prior to that experience, how was the experience of making a feature different than all of the other projects that you had done prior to it?
I don't think it was that different. I just think it was longer. First of all, I still didn't know what in the world I was doing. It was something that my friend Ben and I kind of just jumped into. And so, you know, making short films, you know, you think you know what it's going to be like to make a feature. That's the whole reason why you make shorts, is so you can make a feature. And you try to cram a feature into a short film. But it is different. I will say it is really nice to have a longer time to try to tell a story. But this one was different, too, because we tried to shoot a big chunk of the film in 6 nights. And then the rest of the shoot was like weekends. I think when it was all said and done, it was probably like 18 shooting days, but all like split up. So it was a very like different experience, because we had so much time between shooting certain things, so we could regroup about certain things before we shot them, versus like a normal feature where you would go 18 days in a row and you wouldn't have that. Well, first of all, the thing I learned is I would never do what we did again.
In terms of spreading out the time?
In terms of trying to shoot the bulk of the movie in 6 nights.
Oh, okay.
I think it was right for that time. Like, I'm glad we did it. I definitely would, like, do it again in that term, but not by choice now. I think because of that, we were very limited into what I had talked about before, where I had to plan everything. We had to plan everything. So there wasn't much room for flexibility on set. And I mean, that's kind of the nature of things. I mean, most indie features now, that's kind of the name of the game. You kind of have to find a way around it. So that's not really going to change. But I think I just learned more about how prepared you need to be flexible. And I think I'm just going to keep retouching on that because, I mean, it's still a very hard thing to do. And I still need to work at it.
Well, and it's interesting, too. It's as you keep talking about that, I think about all of the things that creative people do on a daily basis. And very little is it winging things, just improvising, you know, even improv, comedy improv. There's so much prep that goes into that, you know.
Right.
And so learning how to be flexible seems like so much work it takes to do that.
I think something else with that was just learning more how to work with a bigger crew. I think that was probably the biggest, maybe close to the biggest crew I've worked with. It's one thing to make a film with three people, and it's an entirely different kind of beast to work on a film where it's a crew of like 30 or 50 people, or even more than that. Yeah. I haven't had the pleasure of that yet. But with 30 people, it's a totally different way of working, and you have to let go of some control, which has not been an easy thing for me as a creative. But I just think the one big area in that was we had to shoot with two cameras for most of the time in order to meet our schedule. And that was my first time having to do that. And so operating has always been something I've really enjoyed doing, especially on my own stuff. And so that was like the first time I was like, well, there's going to be a B cam operator and I'm operating the A cam. And I'm not going to be able to see really anything they're doing. So I've just got to like let go of that and trust that they'll be able to get what we need.
Yeah.
Like we'll talk about it. This is what we need to get. And then that's it. We don't have time for me to like watch playback or whatever. You know, that film was the start of learning that process. And now I actually prefer, even on single camera shows, to have an operator. Just because of how insightful that person's opinion can be and how much of an ally they can be for you on set to try to achieve what you need to achieve. Because there have been multiple scenarios where it's like, well, this is what we want. Oh, it's not quite working. And then the operator will come up with something of like, well, what if we do this? And it's like, oh, exactly that. That'll do it. And it's just honestly really nice to have somebody working on that kind of stuff while I go attend to other things.
Yeah. That's cool. So we actually met when you were in middle school, I think, either middle school or high school, and especially when you were making feature length stop motion animation movies with Playmobil characters. And when you look back at that time and compare it to where you are today, do you see any similarities?
I think the one similarity is I'm still as ambitious as that high schooler.
How so?
I'll say that. Well, I mean, I still have the dreams of making the next big Lord of the Rings kind of movie. So, and that's what I wanted to do then. So that dream hasn't died.
Nice.
I will say, I think the biggest difference between then and now is during that time, it was obviously all experimentation, just having fun, not really knowing the rules, and just being able to do something that I wanted to do. Which was, I think, invaluable to learning this craft. But I was really good at making stuff with mostly myself. I mean, I was like in a room in my bedroom with these toys with me and a camera, you know. And, you know, a few friends would come and help here and there. But a lot of times it was just me and not people because it was really easy to make a film that way.
Yeah.
Making a film with people, I think, is a lot more enjoyable. It's a lot more difficult just because, you know, communication can sometimes not be the best. And art is a very personal thing for a lot of people. And so sometimes you walk that fine line of offending somebody or encouraging them. Depends on the relationship. So I don't think I am the same person whatsoever who made those mm-hmm. Playmobil toys. But I needed to be that person then in order to be the person I am now.
Yeah. Well, and that self-reflection is really cool. And I use you as an example often when someone asks me how to be a filmmaker. And I go back in my mind to watching you do those films and just the drive to get started, the drive to make something, developing a vision, and that constant learning and trying of new things. And so how do you find yourself growing in your craft these days, much like when you were just alone in a room pursuing the stories that you wanted to tell?
I think that, I mean, then it was just picking up the camera and doing it and roping as many friends into it as I could. Mm-hmm. Back then, I don't think there was anything that would stop me. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't let anything stop me from doing what I wanted to create. But I think now it's obviously way different because I'm not striving to be a director like I was way, way back then. Mm-hmm. So I depend upon a lot of people.
Yeah.
I have to get hired in order to do what I want to do. It's not just me doing my own thing. But I will say there have been times these past few years where there might be a lull in something and I just have the itch to make something. Mm-hmm. And so I still do go out and just do my own thing.
Nice.
I think a few years ago, I just did just like a fan-made music video because that's like my thing to do since high school for a Damien Rice song. And I was like, you know what? I've got an idea for this and let's just go out and make it. Mm-hmm. And we did. It filled that creative void I had at that time. And also, it's just like with every project, you're going to learn something. And I think that's what I try to carry over. If there's something not coming my way, I've got to find something. If that is even just me going out and doing something.
Yeah, that's great.
Because the more you work, the more you learn, and the more potential other projects will come your way. In this town, especially like now, with like so much accessibility to everybody's lives, like if you're not constantly sharing something, you can sometimes be forgotten. So it's that fine balance, though, of still doing like the projects you want to do, but still not just sitting at home doing nothing.
Yeah. Well, being based out of LA, you're surrounded by an amazing amount of world-class talent. So how do you manage or avoid entirely the process of comparing yourself and your work to other people?
Well, I think first of all, that's impossible not to.
Yeah.
I mean, there's times where I'll get really down on myself in the compare game. Mm-hmm. I'm just looking at other people's stuff like, oh man, I'm just never going to get there. Or I just feel like, I want to get there faster. But I think it's just learning, especially with this industry, like patience is the key. And it is a long-term career. Mm-hmm. Like your career is not just one project. I think it's some of the best advice I got while I was at AFI. Your career is not one project. Your career is decades. So you got to look at the long-term and not just put everything into just like one project and not be discouraged by one project, whether it comes or not. Mm-hmm. But I think what I found that really helps counter sometimes my competitiveness, and not, competitiveness is good, but I mean more like the like ugly side of competitiveness of where you want to tear somebody else down to make yourself better. I think to combat that, I've found that having colleagues that you really respect and you cheer on really helps put your work into perspective, and it just makes it more exciting. Yeah. I went to AFI and graduated last June and came out of there with a lot of good friends who are cinematographers. And I think that's kind of like the most exciting thing coming out of that school is like, I really hope these friends do better than I do. Hmm. I hope they have better careers than me and that I can be there to help them and cheer them on.
Yeah.
And I think with that, it then puts you into a better place of like, you know, I'm going to still do the best I can with mine, but it's okay if I think it's not as good as theirs.
Yeah. Well, and that's a really good point, too, because whether you're in Hollywood or Portland or Seattle or, you know, Tulsa or New York, it's all about relationships. It's all about, you know, having that group of people that you're cheering on and you can rely on.
Yeah, definitely. And then it just creates a great environment where, I mean, we're texting all the time about cinematography, geeky things, and bouncing ideas off of each other. And if I didn't have that camaraderie, then like, it's a pretty lonely place to be.
Yeah.
I think as many friends as you can get that are in your field, and yeah, they might beat you out for the job, but at the end of the day, like you said, I think relationships are more important than work. Mm-hmm. And honestly, that's why I love this work, is because it is all about relationships and the amount of people you get to work with and friendships you make through projects you do, I think is the biggest draw for me in this industry.
So one of the things that I've always appreciated with you, Nathan, is how much music inspires the work that you do. So how does music really inform your approach to visual storytelling?
That's a good question. Yeah, music's like, I think sometimes almost bigger than movies or film is in my life.
Yeah.
It's always the thought of like, if I had a second life, I'd probably be a musician, but I probably wouldn't be very good. But I would say like the mood and tone, because music really affects my emotions. And for ever since I can remember, it has been a lot of the source of inspiration for like things I've written or films I've made. And some of that is lyrically with songs, but a lot of it is just like the emotion of a song. And I'm more drawn to the harder side of music, to like metalcore, and hard rock. And I think with that, I'm drawn to more of the music that kind of has like emotional arcs within the music. When a song can take me on a journey, I think that's what really inspires me to then try to translate that into my work. It's funny, for Made Me Do It, the director and I sat down and we listened through a whole album during prep, because he wanted to try to convey the sound of that album into the film.
Which album?
The band was Under Oath, and the album was Lost in the Sound of Separation. It's honestly one of my favorite albums. It's probably in my top 10. And I think it's because that band, the textures they achieve in their music is just so interesting to me. I think that's one thing I love about metal and metalcore, is like there's so many layers to the music, and so you can listen through the album so many times and you get different things out each time. But it had a very frenetic energy to it, and if and when you see Made Me Do It, I think that came across
cool
with the flashback, certainly, of just that frenetic, unpredictable quality with lots of varying textures. So yeah, I think it influences me in subtle ways, but I'm just drawn to music of what, in my opinion, is like high caliber of like, if I listen to a song and it doesn't feel like they put much effort into the lyrics or into the song making, I'm not very interested in that music, even if it's got a catchy hook.
Yeah.
More so with lyrics. Like if there's not effort in the lyrics, I'm kind of not as interested. And so I'm drawn to what I think is high caliber music. And that inspires me to be the best that I can be at what I'm doing. There's one lyric from my favorite band of all time, Project 86, just because I've been listening to them since middle school and they haven't let me down yet. This one little lyric that I kind of just hung on to, and I think I've always hung on to, is I'd rather die than settle for mediocrity. With music, I've always sought out the music that was pushing the edge and pushing the creative boundaries, and taking that to try to translate that into what I do, even though it's, you know, totally two different mediums.
Right. Apart from music, what's one movie that completely changed how you think about cinematography?
Ooh. Oh, there's so many. I've got to do the shout out to Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring. I mean, that's not specifically cinematography, but that's what made me want to make movies.
Yeah.
That was the, yeah, this is what I want to do.
Nice.
Cinematography. That's a tough one. Because there's a lot of movies where it's kind of re-inspired me of like, that's the kind of movie I want to make. This is what I want to do. I'm trying to think. There was a certain point, definitely in undergrad, where I started to become aware of cinematography. And I don't think it's a single film, but I'm just going to name some films that I just go back to with cinematography. Yeah. And one is The Fountain.
Yes.
I think that's the most poetic film ever made.
Mm-hmm.
Also, The Village.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably not the most popular opinion, but it's my favorite Deacon shot movie. Just for the simplicity of how they cover scenes, I think it's fantastic. There's also just certain cinematographers' careers as like a whole you just start to notice their subtleties in what they do. And I think as I keep learning about cinematography and all the tools you have access to and whatnot, I think just revisiting Wally Pfister's work is always inspiring. Seamus McGarvey's work, Masanobu's work. I think those are kind of the my guys I go to. I do want to mention too, Fury was like the last movie that really inspired me visually, just with what they did with that movie. I thought it was great. That's when I walked away and I texted you. I was like, that's the kind of movie I want to make. I think it's been an ever evolving. I don't think there's just one movie that completely changed how I think about cinematography. I think it's like, I think it's every movie, every TV show I watch. I just watch things differently than most people because I'm a cinematographer, so I'm looking for certain things. Yeah. I learned the most not only from like doing, but from watching. I remember in high school I got a Hollywood Video subscription. Like you could buy like the 3 month, like you can rent like three movies at a time.
Nice.
Whatever thing. So I did like 3 months. And in those 3 months I tried to watch as many movies as possible. Even in one of those months, my mom made a rule that I can only watch movies made before 1960. So then it also like awesome. Forced me to watch older stuff. Cause at that time I was like, I don't want to watch black and white movies, which I was a fool for that. There's a lot of stuff from this year that a lot of movies from this year that have changed my perspective of just like the top three for me this year were Dunkirk, Lady Bird, and I, Tonya. And the cinematography in all three of those movies are completely different, but are so right for each of those stories. And I was just blown away by each one.
Well, final question. We're already at the end of this interview. And so, yeah, if you could work with anyone, alive or dead, who would it be and why?
I think I'd have to say Peter Jackson. I think just because he's the reason why I'm even doing this. So nice. I think it would be a real pleasure to work with him.
Awesome. Well, Nathan, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. As always, it's a pleasure to talk with you about film and story and reminiscing on where we've been the last, 15 years. So thanks for taking some time today.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. And I always have a great time just discussing life and film and art with you. And honestly, can't wait to do it again.
Coffee on me next time.
All right, deal.
That does it for this episode of Getting Work to Work. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this podcast. It means so much to me that you do. Would you be willing to share Getting Work to Work with your friends, other creative professionals, and entrepreneurs? You can send them to gwtw.co or have them search for Getting Work to Work on most podcast platforms. Got a few moments to let me know what you think of the show? Head to Getting Work to Work on Apple Podcasts, click ratings and reviews, and either click the number of stars to rate the show or write a review. Thank you so much. Would you like to be a guest on a future episode of Getting Work to Work or know someone who should be on the show? Maybe you need some advice or just want someone to say hi to. Drop me a line by sending me an email. I'm chris@chrismartinstudios.com. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.